Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. It's festival time, Arkansas Literary Festival time, when authors, books and everything that can possibly be added come to Little Rock. One of the books, now also in paperback, is Canada, Richard Ford's latest novel. And when it came out, I was hoping to have the chance to talk to him. So was thrilled to see his name listed with the authors coming to Little Rock for the 10th Annual Arkansas Literary Festival. Brad Moy, the festival coordinator, helped me to get in touch with Richard Ford. He and I had talked when The Lay of the Land was published, the third in the Frank Bascom trilogy, for which Independence Day the second he won the Pulitzer Prize. Then, as now, I was drawn in by his awareness, his sense of environment, great descriptions of the space in which he places his characters. Among the acknowledgements at the back of the book was one to a friend who had lent him a house to write in Great Falls, Montana. So is that why so much of the first part of Canada is in Great Falls?
I can't answer why as much. I've always liked to have the words Great Falls on the page. And over the course of the years that I have been putting it on the page, I've gotten to know it quite well. And it's a very accommodating place for me, very plausible place insofar as you could set almost anything down there and have it happen. And it's in fact, it is a cut of congeries of all kinds of different vocations, and there's an Air Force base there, obviously, and there, you know, it's farming community, it's a railroad community, it has that sort of little nexus quality, which I like. I think even if it were not to have that, I would still probably make it up and want to use it just so that I could have Great Falls on the page.
You said that you had a brief meeting with Del Parsons several years before you wrote the book, that you kept with his character in mind, determined to write this story. But at that point, had you also begun to fashion a background for him?
No. What I did was, and I wrote about 20 pages that somebody, and I don't think even at that time I gave him the name Del Parsons, that somebody narrated. And it was a story that I wrote by hand with a pencil about some kid being made to cross the border from the United States to Saskatchewan against his will, and then set it aside for 20-plus years for various reasons, good reasons. And when I came back to the idea, I found that having a character do that, cross the border against his will, still had for me a kind of what Henry James calls an availability. And when I realized that it was available to me still after all those years, then I had to fashion up, well, why would a character cross the border at 15 years old against his will? And then what would happen to him once he was across the border against his will? So that was all sort of filled in. Or even, I hate to call it filled in because there wasn't even a space for it. I just had to make up those pretextual bits of narration.
Well, did you place yourself in his persona and write it as a memoir so that you started at the beginning and went through to the end?
No. I did start it at the beginning and went through to the end. I did do that. But no, for me, memoir is a very different animal. The way in which, for instance, one would choose words, the modest and minor thing is choosing words, is entirely different. Because when you're writing a memoir and you're trying to choose a word, you have a referent already there. And when you're writing a piece of fiction and you're choosing a word, you don't have a referent already there. Or if you have one, you're willing to abandon it if you get a better word. That's really what it means for a piece of writing to be factual and to have the fidelity effect, whereas a piece of imaginative writing has no such fidelity.
But if you're writing an imaginative fictional memoir?
No, you still wouldn't have anything as a solid reference because none of those things had ever happened. I mean, unless you should just by happenstance be fictionalizing something that I myself did,
yes.
And I that's not any of the truth of this story that I wrote about Del Parsons. I didn't do any of those.
Okay, I understand. It was such a convincing progression from the earliest pre-birth of the twins' time through their first pillar to post in the Air Force and the followings of their erratic father to the longer part two, which were just the bare 6 weeks of his stay in Canada, becoming an abandoned child, had no way to fight what suddenly landed upon the two of them.
Well, you know, at that age of 15, at least as I perceived it in writing this book, you're at that sort of pivot point between childhood and adulthood. If you could be brought along through the agency of a caring family toward adulthood, you could actually begin to take on those conditions in an orderly fashion. In Dell's case, he couldn't take them on in an orderly fashion. He was sort of splashed from one side to the other. I mean, he was put into the unenviable position of having to act almost as an adult without really the armament for adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think here I'm sort of telling an untruth. I'm talking about him as if he was a real person, which he isn't. But when he makes clear that he doesn't have the armament for adulthood, it's because he's just been overmatched by the facts, and all he has is the sort of almost passivity of a wounded child.
And the fact that he was a twin and was dominated by his older, by 3 minutes or something, sister,
yes,
gave him the natural follower to her lead, and she didn't really want to lead him.
I think she was just typical of 15-year-old girls maturing a little more quickly than he was. He was fairly succinct in his sense of himself as a 15-year-old. It's just that the match between them was a slightly sort of unbalanced
mm-hmm.
match. I never thought that, and at least I was never intending that Bernard dominate him. I was just thinking that she was, by the time they were 15, she was preoccupied with herself, and she was a little bit exclusive of him. He didn't put him in an abject or a disadvantageous position in his life because he had he had all the surroundings of his own life, and his parents liked him.
Yes, and he certainly, when she did just walk out of his life, when the parents were taken off to prison, he seemed to be relatively resigned to wait and see what happened next instead of running after her, me too, wait for me sort of thing.
I think what he was he was a loved child, and he had the faith that a loved child would have,
mm-hmm.
that things were going to turn out better than, in fact, well, than they were, but better than they seemed to be likely to turn out at the moment his parents were thrust into prison. And I think everything that Dell depends on in his life, all through the book, from beginning to its end, have chiefly to do with having been a loved child.
Ah, yes. He certainly had a lot of sympathy, even with that extraordinary character, Charlie, whose tragedies and background you never find out. You just have to imagine yourself what
well,
exactly.
He's a secondary character.
Yes,
so
but he's a very powerful
really
one.
I want to treat him with the same degree of completeness. As a novelist, you want your secondary characters to be eminently useful to you. Drop them in tenses.
Did you examine into the history so that you could describe so convincingly the slaughter of the geese and the way Charlie deals with the corpses and all the appurtenances that he puts to one side for the birds to eat and the coyotes to eat and things like that?
Done it all myself. But that's really probably why the story is set in Saskatchewan, because when I first went to Saskatchewan in the 80s with Raymond Carver, we went to shoot geese.
You were among the Americans who went up to Canada to shoot the geese.
Yes, we were. We were those very same bad Americans, although we weren't very bad.
So, like with The Lay of the Land, you know your settings so perfectly, so intimately, that you had to have been there and to have put them aside for how many years until you brought them together?
It just so happens that I have been to those places. I mean, I probably haven't written about very many places that I haven't been to, although I would like to think that it's not a requirement. I would like to think that since you're making places up, you could look at something on a map and you could do a little reading and you could prepare yourself in that way and write about Omaha, or you could write about wherever you wanted to
mm-hmm.
write about. Just by doing your homework and not ever having been there. I mean, it is, after all, not creating the place itself on the page. It's creating a viable and plausible background against which the characters do what they do, so that a place in a novel, for me anyway, a place is always of secondary importance.
When you were creating Del and his sister, Del devolves into somebody who obviously craves knowledge and education.
Yes, he does.
And he has this little search for subjects that he really wants, like bees, and to want to pursue it if he only can find somebody or some book. Obviously, the sort of child who should be let loose in a library to browse for as long as he wants.
Yes.
And that sustains him through a lot, because though he can't take his bees with him when he goes up with his pillowcase to Canada, there are other things, and you hear about them. Even in the brief 6 weeks that he's there, he learns to swamp a room and take some pride in it, into things that are pretty menial, but he's got the wit to realize that everything he does is something he can learn from.
That's right. That's right. But I think those kinds of chores for a 15-year-old boy, when you're really in the presence of what adults are doing, and particularly when you're in the presence of what adults are doing behind closed doors when they don't want to be seen, is pretty exotic. I mean, if you did it for a lifetime, if you swamped rooms for a lifetime, the exoticism would wear through pretty fast. And in his case, he just doesn't do it for a lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a chance for him to become independent. It's a chance for him to operate out of other people's sight. It's a chance, as you say, for him to learn something. So the avidity with which he goes at it seems to me to be a natural avidity.
Yes. His sister, though, is such a tragic figure. Certainly towards the end.
She comes to an unhappy end.
But she seemed unhappy from the very beginning.
Well, we unfortunately catch her in the midst of puberty.
Oh, okay.
And she's already not becoming, by her own estimation, a handsome girl, a pretty girl. And so she's just struggling with being a 15-year-old girl and feeling her own sexuality and feeling a little cooped up in her family and not being able to see her boyfriend when she wants to. I never thought of her as a child as unhappy. I just thought of her as bursting at the seams.
Yeah. And you did pick the time in anybody's life growing when they begin to be aware a little bit and more and more disconcertingly your position in the world, and you're full of phrases that one or two of them are very much sort of aphorisms that I latched on because I love the sound of them. But you have one where Del is thinking about time, and I quote your comment that time closes over events if you don't know much about time. And time meant little to me there. And when does one know about time? For him, obviously.
Well, probably you know something about time when you begin to have something to gain from an awareness of it.
So the implicit meaning that, for me, would be that he learnt so much more about others and the world around him in that part two that only lasts 6 weeks, compared with all that had gone before him when he and his sister and mother were moved as the father dictated in terms of where he was sent when he was still in the Air Force and then where he decided to go and what plans he then made, which, of course, in the end were catastrophic.
Exactly. But he had no purpose for time at that point in his life. And, you know, you have to think about what makes us.
And then that's when it brings me back to the pattern of your book, how you wrote it. Would you write the passage of book one right through to where they go to the Great Falls?
Yeah, I always write books in order.
Ah, okay.
I've never not written books in the order that I want them to be in on the page, and I almost never write books living or even close to the places where they occur, because I think if you are too wedded to the facts, then you don't get to develop things away from the facts by the agency of your imagination to make them more interesting.
Yes.
I mean, the place that Great Falls is on the map in Montana, or on the earth in Montana, has only to do with the place in my book Now and Then, and particularly the qualities of life there that I ascribe to it. I mean, the places more or less are in order, in that the river is on the, you know, more or less on the west side, and the mountains is to the west, and the plains is to the east, and Canada is to the north. But moving things around within that context is something I want to be able to do, yeah, depending on how I, you know, end up writing a sentence. I mean, I remember one time the New Yorker was publishing something of mine that I had said in Great Falls, and they wrote me, well, I guess they called because it was before email. And the fact checker said, you know, Mr. Ford, you said that the YWCA was at 613 4th Avenue South, but we've looked, and it's actually at 1751 10th Avenue North. He said, would you mind if we just changed that back to the way it really is? I said, no, because that has too many syllables in it.
What did he say?
Well, they said, well, what are you talking about? I said, I'm talking about the fact that this is a piece of fiction, so get out of here.
So it appeared as you wrote it.
Yes.
Good for you.
Yeah.
As you say, when I was asking about memoir, the difference between what a child or a fictional character is remembering is very different from what you, right, as a writer, remember.
Right.
The other one or two other things that I just thought were wonderful phrases. Parrots speak too, only out of despair.
Oh, yeah.
Now, is that something you just picked out of fresh air?
I read it. I got it out of my parrot book.
You got a parrot book. Wouldn't I know that?
Looked it up in the parrot dictionary.
I'll try that. Mm. Yes.
But there isn't very much after that.
That was well-known author Richard Ford coming to Little Rock next weekend for the 10th Annual Arkansas Literary Festival, which runs April 18th through 21st. His latest novel, Canada, is now on paperback, published by EchoBooks.com, an imprint of HarperCollins. For full details of the Literary Festival, visit ArkansasLiteraryFestival.org.
The night is young.
Some events this week. Today in Hot Springs, catch the final performance of The Little Foxes as the Pocket Community Theater closes its run with a 2:30 performance. And the Art Church Studio is closing till September, moving to the historic Dryden Pottery space after that is remodeled. So it's hosting an open house and picnic in the 341 Whittington Avenue building also today. Then in Fayetteville today, see Anything Goes at the Walton Arts Center. April the 18th, Theatre Squared opens its production of Next to Normal, a musical and Tony Award winner, in the Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studio Theatre, running through May the 12th. In Conway, April the 15th, the UCA Public Appearances presents The Five Browns, Five Siblings and Five Grand Pianos, 7:30 in Reynolds Performance Hall, where April the 20th, also at 7:30, the Conway Symphony Concert features Kurt Thompson in the Bruch Violin Concerto. And across town, three events at Hendricks College. April the 15th, the Wind Ensemble Concert is 5:30 on the lawn outside Staples Auditorium, for rain inside the auditorium. April the 17th, the Hendricks College Chamber Players present a lecture recital at 7:30 in Reeves Recital Hall, where April the 18th, same time, same place, in the Literature and Medicine series, hear a panel discussion on warrior writers and combat paper projects, with Drew Cameron, an Iraq War veteran, Jan Berry, a Vietnam veteran, and Sarah Nesson, a documentary film director. Also 7:30 in Reeves Recital Hall.
Here's a look at what's happening in the arts in Central Arkansas. This afternoon at 3, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra performs Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto with guest soloist Midori at Robinson Center Music Hall. At UALR this afternoon, Artspree presents Triple Play with Chris Brubeck, 3 p.m. at Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall. Then Tuesday, Triple Play performs at Harding University in Searcy, 7 p.m. at the Administration Auditorium. Tuesday, the Arkansas Symphony's River Rhapsody series wraps up with a program featuring Copeland's Appalachian Spring, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Presidential Center's Great Hall. The Architecture and Design Network presents a lecture by Kevin McClurkin of Aeneid Architects in New York, titled Threads, about the firm's most recent works, Tuesday, 6 p.m. at the Arkansas Art Center Lecture Hall. Friday and Saturday at Weekend Theater, Doubt, a Parable, shows at 7:30 each night. And Saturday at the Arkansas Art Center, When Dreams Are Interrupted, the Purple Moon Dance Project, presented in collaboration with the exhibition Wendy Murayama, Executive Order 9066, about Japanese internment camps. The performance is at 2 p.m. Other exhibits currently on display at the Art Center, Edward Weston, Leaves of Grass, and the 52nd Young Arkansas Artists Exhibition. Elsewhere around town, at Historic Arkansas Museum, Treasures of Arkansas Freemasons, 1838-2013, at the Clinton Presidential Center, Jazz Through the Eyes of Herman Leonard, and at Lehman Library in North Little Rock, Portraits in Gray, a Civil War photography exhibition. And that's a look at the arts calendar for this week. For more on what's going on in Arkansas, visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org.
The UALR Department of Theater Arts and Dance is preparing its annual spring dance concert, and things seem to be humming in that section of the department. So Stephanie Thibault, Associate Professor of Dance, came by to talk about the upcoming program, Bodyworks, set for next weekend. There are also plans to take a group of dancers on tour in June, a project called State of Being, which is referred to in the following conversation, but details will follow nearer the time. I did ask if the two projects were related.
It's very much a separate project. However, there's crossover because some of the same dancers are being used. And one of the new works that I'm developing, I've developed on UALR dancers and will premiere in the spring concert and then will be transferred to some other dancers in the spring.
How many of these dancers that you're taking on tour are still in the department program?
Actually, the way it turned out, when I first started, I had invited several dancers to be part of the project, and it looked like it was going to be five dancers from UALR and five non-UALR dancers. And in theory, I liked that mix. I liked that it was not going to feel just like a school trip. These dancers would be interacting with each other. As it stands now, eight of my 10 dancers are UALR dancers. One of them is a UALR alum as well, and then I have another one who is a dancer who's moved back here after living and working in New York City. Of the eight that are currently UALR students, I think all of them are going to be back next year. So they get to bring something back from their experience to share with the other dancers.
And then the program, then the Bodyworks in April.
Yes.
Will have the dancers that are still in the department, but they won't have the outside dancers.
Yes, the new piece that I'm creating is all UALR dancers. I think there are three out of the six of them that will be touring with us, and then the other parts will be taken over by other people. There's a new work that I'll be presenting, and we'll talk about that, in a concert coming up at UALR, and it's called Engendered Species, and it's all about gender identity. And this is one of the two new works that I'm creating as part of this project for the tour.
But how much of that now are you extrapolating to create something new in this program that comes up in April? Because isn't this also choreography of some of the students?
Yes, the concert that we have at UALR, that's April 18th through 21st, it is our spring concert. We call it Bodyworks. It features the work of faculty and sometimes guest artists. This year, it's all faculty works with a couple of student works that we've brought back from the fall. These were exceptional works that we took recently to American College Dance Festival, where we had professional dancers and choreographers giving feedback. And I must say, I was very proud of our students in their performance and their choreography, because we came through that with flying colors and everyone just raved, couldn't even believe they were student choreographers. And so we were all very proud. So our audiences will get a chance to see those works again, along with faculty works. The new work that I'm creating for this concert, Engendered Species, is one of the new works that I'm also taking on this tour. Mm-hmm. But another work of mine that I'm bringing back is called American Dream, and it was one that I was commissioned by Ballet Arkansas to create this work, And they've been so kind as to agree to appear on the concert and show another form of my work. Now, this concert is not all about my work, but I can speak personally about that. So I have a third work that I'm bringing back that is called Covetous, The Bond Endures, and it's about the complex relationships between women. Our other faculty members, Rhythm McCarthy and Stephen Stone, are also choreographing on this concert. Ms. McCarthy has a couple of wonderful new works. One of them is all based on a sculpture that's been created just for this work. And then, she started collaborating with someone to work on the sculpture, mm-hmm. and then they've used that as a jumping off point for the work and interacting with the sculpture. And I'd even say the whole work has a sculptural feel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other work of hers, it's a little bit different from that. She talks about their partner being the costumes. So in that sense, you know, she has another influence that helps shape the work. And I think this one perhaps even takes it one step further in that the costumes are an integral part of this particular piece, and they have their own movement that's created mm-hmm, by the costumes. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Stephen Stone is directing a 20-minute boiled down excerpts from Chicago. So Chicago, the musical. So there's definitely something for everyone in this show.
Is that going to be on the finale?
It is also going to be on finale, our annual fundraiser mm-hmm. for the college. And it's very exciting. It's got live vocals as well as movement. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. It's been a really wonderful experience for a lot of our dancers. And we have people from the music department, students from the music department taking part in it.
Back to the students and what they're up to.
Yes.
The BFA, how is that going? And how many do you have enrolled in that?
It's wonderful. When we started with our degree program, we said that we could maybe handle about 30 majors because of facilities and various other aspects. And that's about where we are right now. The difference being that there's been some natural attrition, people that have decided this isn't for them, and more serious dancers that have come into the program. We have an even more selective group of those 31 majors or whatever.
Are they coming from out of state, or is it still within the state?
Many of them are from in-state, but we are having some from Texas, Oklahoma. We've been getting some more interest from out of state. Somebody from Alabama coming soon, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Tennessee coming next year. So
they're
starting, the word's getting out. And, these things that we do, like the American College Dance Festival Association's conference that we just went to, people see what we're doing, and we're doing something right because our dancers look beautiful.
Is it regional the way that the regional ballet festival is?
It's not set up exactly the same way, but it does go in regions. We just had the very first conference for the new South region. There are now 12 regions for the American College Dance Festival Association. And I'm not really that familiar with RDA. I just know about it. But these are all college and university programs that come together.
The format is probably the same for mm-hmm. dance and theater and music and all these other things mm-hmm. that they do to bring the neophytes into the greater world, away from
yes.
their home base, and get them used to being mm-hmm. adjudicated by people other than friendly faces.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's part of why, on my project, part of why I wanted to do this is I love everyone around here seeing what we're doing, but it's nice for our dancers to be in front of other people and meeting other people. But the degree program, the BFA, I just feel like it's really taking off. We're now in the fourth official year. This is the middle of my fifth year here. You can see that there's a program now, and there are upperclassmen that when the freshmen come in, they can look up to, and we're establishing a culture. It comes from the faculty and the students. There's influences on both sides, and I really like the culture that we've developed in our program.
Stephanie Thiebaud, Associate Professor of Dance in the Department of Theatre Arts and Dance at UALR. The spring dance concert, Body Works, will run April 18th through 21st in the University Theatre, UALR's Centre for the Performing Arts, Thursday through Saturday at 8 p.m. and 2:30 on Sunday. For tickets, call 501-569-3456. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.